It's time for The Last Word, where Jonathan Capehart is in for Lawrence. This is a much more familiar world for me, where I end my show and give it to you, because that's what we do on Sunday mornings.
Right, on Sunday mornings. And I guess we're going to be doing it again tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
Yes, right. Well, thanks very much, Allie.
Have a good evening.
Thanks a lot, Allie. It's about damn time. That's how Congressman Bill Pascrell, a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, described the Justice Department's announcement that the Treasury Department must turn over 6 years of Donald Trump's tax returns to House investigators on the committee. The committee first made the request 849 days ago. The Bill Barr Justice Department, which basically operated as the Donald Trump Justice Department, blocked Trump's returns from being released, despite the fact that the law is absolutely clear that the Treasury Department shall turn over any tax document requested by a tax writing committee in the Congress. Today, Merrick Garland's Justice Department says that the committee's request to see the records is lawful, valid, and should be fulfilled. Quote, applying the proper degree of deference due the committee, we believe that there is ample basis to conclude that its June 2021 request for former President Trump's tax information would further the committee's principal stated objective of assessing the IRS's presidential audit program, a plainly legitimate area for congressional inquiry and possible legislation. Ways and Means Chairman Richard Neal said this about the decision, as I have maintained for years, the committee's case is very strong and the law is on our side. I am glad the Department of Justice agrees and that we can move forward. And then there's this from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who called the decision a victory for congressional oversight powers. Quote, access to former President Trump's tax return is a matter of national security. The American people deserve to know the facts of his troubling conflicts of interest and undermining of our security and democracy as president. Leading off our discussion tonight is Congressman Lloyd Doggett of Texas. He is the second highest ranking Democrat on the House Ways and Means Committee. Congressman Doggett, thank you very much for being here. The immediate question for you is this. When do you get Donald Trump's tax returns?
Not yet, but this was an important step in getting us there, Jonathan. And it is important to remember how we got to this point today. Donald Trump lied about his willingness to disclose his tax returns. As the public outcry over that began to intensify, he presented us in the committee a letter from his law firm that there was nothing to look at, not noting that that same law firm was named the Russia Law Firm of the Year. For years, for months at least, the House Republicans on our committee covered up for him. I made 6 motions. Other colleagues made motions. They refused to use a law that grew out of another Republican scandal almost 100 years ago. The same law that figured in Richard Nixon saying, I'm not a crook, over his tax deductions. And the law is clear. It requires that the Treasury Secretary or the IRS Commissioner, who's been delegated that responsibility, shall deliver returns when they're requested. And what we've had now for months, then years, is an unwillingness to comply with that very clear law. Now that we have this decision, it's really a question of just what Mr. Trump's next tactic is to try to hide the evidence that I think will show his tax evasion.
Well, Congressman Doggett, on this question of, you know, handing over the returns when they are requested, here's something from the DOJ decision where it says the June 2021 request seeks the same categories of information as the April 2019 request, but it covers each of the tax years 2015 to 2020, whereas the April 2019 request asked for tax information for the tax years 2013 through 2018. My question to you is, why the change in years requested? Why is that significant?
Well, I think it was just an updating of the prior request to bring it up to date. I actually think the request, and we provided for this in the For the People Act, should cover 10 years. But the main point is that the committee has crafted a narrow legislative request. And that is to be able to ensure that the audit that President Trump kept using as an excuse is being conducted properly and not the result of his manipulation or intimidation of the Internal Revenue Service. So Chairman Neal has used that as the reason for getting these returns. He also, in this updated request that he filed in June, mentions the very real possibility of foreign entanglements. We know the Saudi money, the Russian money that appeared to pour into some of Mr. Trump's accounts, and the effect on legislation here in Congress that relates to taxes. So we have a good basis for getting it. It's just a question now, with a court case pending, of whether Trump comes up with yet more excuses, perhaps files an injunction to try to block what will eventually happen when this clear law is implemented, but which he is determined to delay as long as possible. I don't believe any president has ever tried so hard to hide so much. There is much at stake here, and it's really important that we get this information. Once we have it, that's not a guarantee that it remains public. In fact, it would be a criminal offense if I were to disclose that information prematurely. It will be a matter of our committee looking at the documents in private. I'm sure there'll be a substantial amount of them, and determining in a report whether any of this should be made public after we see what's there.
And how soon would that be, do you think?
Well, I think it won't be soon enough for me. I've been trying to get this for years, but I want a fair examination, recognizing the privacy rights of any person, but that particularly with reference to a president of the United States who can manipulate a tax system that relies on voluntary compliance for most taxpayers, and that they see this as being done fairly. In that circumstance, I believe we have a good case, but should take our time to look at it carefully, but not indefinitely. And the sooner that this mound of documents can be reviewed, the sooner a decision can be made as to whether any of it is appropriate for public disclosure. That would take a vote in our committee. And, you know, our Republican colleagues back a few years ago, when it was Lois Lerner and a group that they were claiming was intimidating right-wing organizations, they didn't hesitate to disclose personal returns. They took a public vote. It may be up to our committee at some point to take a vote as to whether to report some portions of this as public.
I bet there's going to be clamoring for some kind of vote like that. Congressman Lloyd Doggett, thank you very much for coming to The Last Word. Joining us now are David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter who has done extensive reporting on Trump's taxes. He's the author of The Making of Donald Trump. And Matt Miller, former spokesman for Attorney General Eric Holder and an MSNBC contributor. Thank you both very much for being here. David, I'm going to start with you because you know all when it comes to Donald Trump's taxes. And so what do you think Congress is going to see when they finally do get that committee, when Congressman Doggett finally gets those taxes in front of him?
Well, when they get the tax return information, they're going to see clear evidence of calculated fraud. And I base that in good part on the fact that Donald has had two civil tax fraud trials by the state of New York and the city of New York. Not only did he lose them both, but his own tax lawyer in one of the trials testified that Donald had forged his own tax return. So there's no reason to believe that his tax returns will show that he's an honest man, that he's done all this fighting as a matter of principle. He's done it because he knows he's a major league tax cheat.
And David, how will this, if at all, dovetail with the Manhattan District Attorney's investigation and also what the state attorney general is doing in New York?
Well, the state level officials in New York have the tax information, and they've actually had much of it for a long time because New York state tax returns, which they already had, and federal returns are almost identical for residents of New York State. I fully expect that there will be an indictment of Donald Trump for tax fraud and also for racketeering under Article 460 of the New York Penal Code. And the attorney general has only civil authority unless granted it by the governor. She is continuing her investigation. We don't know exactly what charges will grow out of that or what civil actions, but I think Donald will face both civil and criminal actions by the state of New York and by the district attorney in Manhattan.
Matt, earlier this week, the Justice Department dealt a blow to poor Congressman Mo Brooks by saying that they would not be defending him, accusing him of inciting violence on January 6th. Today, the DOJ blessed the handing over of Trump's tax returns. Some people voice concern. I'll just call it bedwetting. A lot of folks on the left bedwetting over Attorney General Merrick Garland and how he was, you know, doing things with the previous administration. But what's your view on this? How do you understand these moves by the Attorney General of late?
Look, I think it was okay to disagree with some of the decisions the Attorney General made previously in the year. I disagreed with some of them, but I do think the criticism that he somehow was an apologist for the previous administration and was trying to do their bidding was completely off base. It was always off base. I think he was trying very hard to follow the rule of law. And it's very difficult early in your tenure as an attorney general to kind of get control of the Justice Department, to see, you know, issues that are coming well in advance so you can have time to make a considered decision about how you might want to change course. And I think they've had time to get their bearings now. And you're starting to see the effects of some of that, you know, of some of those decisions. I think the thing that was so heartening about all of those decisions, and there were several more you didn't even mention, that this week was that they were all you know, kind of grounded in this commitment to the rule of law, and not just the commitment to the rule of law, but really, really grounded in first principles that no man or woman, even the president of the United States, is above the law, that secrecy is important at times for the way the government works, but it can't be used to cover up wrongdoing, that the president himself and his cronies should not be protected by the federal government when there are serious evidence of corruption and illegality. You saw the department acting kind of in all those areas to shore up those really key principles. And I think it shows that the attorney general, the deputy attorney general, the other leaders there, not just smart and capable and committed to the rule of law, but they understand this moment in time we're in where it really is important to uncover the wrongdoing of the last administration and, when appropriate, hold people accountable.
Hold people accountable, Matt, to the point of pursuing criminal action against them?
I think they will when it's appropriate. Look, it wasn't this week, but it was just last week that the Department of Justice indicted the former president's inaugural chair, Tom Barrack, on mm-hmm. very serious charges. And I think they won't hesitate when they have cases, not just where they think someone has broken the law, but when they think they can win a case in court, or when they think the corruption or the illegality is so flagrant that it warrants bringing a case, I don't think you'll hesitate to see them bring charges. Now, that doesn't mean everyone that you or I might want to get indicted is going to be indicted. The department faces, you know, right, very serious hurdles in a lot of these white-collar cases. That's true across the board, and it will be true here. But I think when they have the evidence to bring cases, I think their actions in the past week show that they won't hesitate to do so.
And David, real quickly, last question to you. Given everything you know about Donald Trump and what happened today, particularly with his tax returns, what's his next move?
Oh, he's going to go to court and try to get a temporary restraining order and then a permanent injunction. The law here is very clear. It says that the IRS and the Treasury shall turn these documents over. It's a right the president has. They've made a colorable argument, a facial argument, that there's an issue here. And Donald himself said he was being unfairly treated by the IRS because he was president. That's plenty of grounds for a legitimate congressional inquiry. I'll be very surprised if even the first judge, even if it's a Trump appointee, rules in his favor.
David K. Johnston and Matt Miller, thanks for joining us tonight. Coming up, stunning new details of Donald Trump's obsession with getting the acting attorney general to declare the 2020 election corrupt. Congressman Eric Swalwell and former federal prosecutor Joyce Vance will join us next. Just 10 days before the pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol to disrupt the certification of Joe Biden's election win, Donald Trump pressured top Justice Department officials to declare that the 2020 election was, quote, corrupt. That's according to 9 pages of handwritten notes obtained by the House Oversight Committee of a December 27th phone call between Trump, then acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, and then acting Deputy Attorney General Richard Donahue. According to the notes, Richard Donahue told Trump, quote, understand that the DOJ can't and won't snap its fingers and change the outcome of the election. Doesn't work that way. Trump responded, just say that the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman. Yeah, he actually said that. Trump didn't mention which Republicans he was referring to, but the notes indicate that at other times on the call, he mentioned Congressman Jim Jordan and Scott Perry and Senator Ron Johnson. All three supported Trump's election lies. Joining us now are Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell of California. He served as a House impeachment manager in the second impeachment trial of President Donald Trump and is the author of Endgame, Inside the Impeachments of Donald Trump. And Joyce Vance, former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Alabama and a professor at the University of Alabama School of Law. She is an MSNBC legal contributor. And thank you both very much for being here. Congressman Swalwell, I have to start with you. And it's hard to believe that the second impeachment, of which you were an impeachment manager, was just, it was still this year, just a few months ago. Is there anything, do the notes, 9 pages of notes that we have seen, do they fit with what you possibly saw as an impeachment manager a few months ago?
Part of me wishes that we could impeach him again and make sure that he could never, ever run for office, because he is seeking to do that. And he has all of the elements in place to try and overturn an election again if he tries to run for office. So good evening, Jonathan. Good evening, Joyce. This is what we saw. We saw someone who had such a disdain for the rule of law, such contempt for democracy, that he was willing to destroy it if it served his purpose. Now, we're not going to impeach him again, of course, but we should bring these witnesses in, understand what vulnerabilities he exposed in our government, and then put in place laws so that no future leader, Democratic or Republican, can ever test us in this way again.
Congressman Swalwell, I want to I'm sure you've seen it by now because it's an instant classic. Just here's Jim Jordan today.
Did you speak with President Trump on January 6th?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke with the president last week. I speak with the president all the time. I spoke with him on January 6th.
On January 6th, did you speak with him before, during, or after the Capitol was attacked?
I'd have to go. I spoke with him that day after. I think after. I don't know if I spoke with him in the morning or not. I just don't know. I'd have to go back and I don't know when those conversations happened.
Translation, hamana, 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 hamana. Congressman Swalwell, your reaction to that?
I remember every second of that day, sadly, and there hasn't been a day that's gone by where I haven't thought about that day. So that sounds like somebody who thankfully should not be a investigator for what happened on January 6th. That's exactly why Speaker Pelosi did not allow him to serve. He is a witness. He was a part of propagating the big lie, assembling the mob. And, you know, we need to know what he and Donald Trump were up to and what Donald Trump knew that day and what he did and most importantly did not do to save life and the counting of the votes.
Joyce, I'm going to put up a tweet of yours from today and then have you expound further. You wrote, the fact that DOJ turned these notes over to the House Oversight Committee, the type of internal product they typically fight to protect, suggests that they believe this is very serious, potentially even criminal conduct. Talk further about that.
So DOJ typically will hold close any of its internal work product, particularly notes that a senior official might take during a phone call. That's not something that DOJ turns over without a fight. But in this case, they've made a bold statement indicating that they believe the events here are so important and this information is so critical that they're going to permit former Trump administration folks to give unrestricted testimony. I take that to mean that they're not going to exert any kind of executive privilege. And also, they're turning over the physical documents. This means this is serious stuff. Whether it's criminal or not requires additional investigation, but certainly that investigation is merited.
And Joyce, is this information relevant to what's happening down in Georgia in the investigation, the Fulton County criminal probe into that phone call in which Trump tried to pressure the Georgia Secretary of State Raffensperger to, I think it was, fine me 10,780 votes?
So, Jonathan, the interplay between these two events is pretty interesting, and let me talk about one way that it might be significant. Prosecutors worry a lot about proving a defendant's intent? You know, was he just sort of bumbling and saying stuff, or was there actually a cohesive plan to overturn the results of a legitimate election? And something that makes it more likely that it was intentional rather than an accident or a stumbling is if there's evidence of a repeated course of conduct, and it's actually admissible evidence that you can put in, say Georgia were to indict, prosecutors could very likely offer evidence of other similar related courses of conduct, like this pressure that Trump tried to bring to bear on the Justice Department, to show that it wasn't a mistake, it wasn't unintentional, but rather there was an intentional effort to subvert the election in Georgia.
Congressman Swalwell, considering you've been an impeachment manager and devised questions to ask witnesses, what kinds of questions should investigators be asking now?
Well, at this point, really trying to understand what Donald Trump and those around him knew as to who was going to show up on January 6th. Mo Brooks, who you referenced earlier, he admitted this week that he was wearing body armor when he gave those inciting remarks just outside of the White House. So what did he know that led him to, you know, wear body armor? And what did Donald Trump know about who was showing up? And then, of course, what decisions did he make to protect the Capitol, or what decisions did he not make that could have protected the Capitol? I think that will be incredibly helpful for us as we try and ensure that we again have a peaceful transition of power in this country, one that we did not have in the 2021 transition as we go into the next presidential election.
Congressman Swalwell, one more question to you, and I think you alluded to this earlier, but how concerned are you that we dodged a bullet in 2020 in that we had responsible people who were being pressured by the president of the United States, members of his own party who did not bend to his will did not subvert the Constitution of the United States? How concerned are you that kind of withstanding of pressure won't hold in 2022, the midterm elections?
Jonathan, as I and my colleagues were running from the floor through an evacuation route, that the thought going through my mind was, it can't end this way, that this cannot be how democracy dies. And I thought that's what was going to happen on January 6th. And I would say at best, it's on life support right now, because nothing has changed. Donald Trump is telling people he's coming back in August. Mark Meadows said some pretty disturbing things today about a cabinet meeting they had and plans they have that they're going to announce soon. I mean, he's still assembling a shadow cabinet, it sounds like. And we still don't have the security posture at the Capitol that we need to make sure that we could protect, you know, a future coup attempt. And so I am very, very concerned. And the best thing to inoculate against that would be the unity of Republicans and Democrats really, really debunking the big lie, acknowledging Joe Biden as president, and then putting in place laws so that this won't happen again. Otherwise, again, we're close to a flat line right now for our democracy.
And on that note, we're going to have to leave it there. Congressman Eric Swalwell and Joyce Vance, thank you both for joining us tonight. Coming up, the CDC says the war has changed with the Delta variant. What does that mean for vaccinated people as we approach school and office reopenings? Dr. Uche Blackstock will join us. Today, the CDC released the results of a study of a COVID breakthrough among vaccinated people. The study convinced CDC scientists that the the war has changed. According to an internal report, the CDC concluded that Delta variant vaccine breakthrough cases may be as transmissible as unvaccinated cases. The study is part of the data behind the CDC's recommendation that vaccinated people should wear masks indoors in areas with high or substantial virus transmission. The outbreak at the center of the study happened in Massachusetts, which has the second highest vaccination rate in the nation. 63.9% of its population is fully vaccinated. Over the July 4th weekend in Provincetown, 74% of the 469 people who got infected with the Delta variant were fully vaccinated. Incredibly important to note, only 4 vaccinated people were hospitalized. Not a single person died. The study concludes, vaccination is the most important strategy to prevent severe illness and death. In Las Vegas yesterday, an unvaccinated father of 5 died of COVID. One of his last text messages to his fiance was, quote, "I should have gotten the damn vaccine."
Our babies now don't have a dad. You can't say I'm young and it won't affect me, because it will. I expected to get 30 more years with him. I didn't expect him to be gone.
You're the best dad anyone can have.
Joining us now is Dr. Uche Blackstock, an emergency medical physician. She is also the founder and CEO of Advancing Health Equity and also an MSNBC contributor. Dr. Blackstock, thank you very much for being here. It's just heartbreaking to see what that family is going through, knowing the text message that that father of five sent to his family just before he died. What are we learning from the new CDC data about the importance of getting the vaccine?
Right. First of all, thank you so much for having me, Jonathan. I think what this data is showing, and then the game changer, is that breakthrough infections, although still very rare, fully vaccinated individuals who are infected carry a lot of virus with them, as much virus as someone who is unvaccinated. And so there is a possibility that those fully vaccinated infected people may actually be able to transmit infection to unvaccinated individuals. And that was not the case with prior versions of this virus.
Let me show everyone a tweet that you sent out this morning. And it was a conversation you had with someone on the street. You wrote, "Just got stopped on the street by an older black man who has seen me on MSNBC. And he wanted to share that he had successfully convinced two friends of his, also older black men, to get vaccinated today. This vaccination effort is a grassroots effort too." Dr. Blackstock, I'm wondering, are more people getting vaccinated like that man, not only because of seeing you on TV, but news of the surge is moving people to get vaccinated?
Well, we know that in states that have seen, most profound upticks in cases, that they've also seen an increase in vaccination. So I do think to some level, this Delta variant is scaring, or rather motivating, some people to get vaccinated. But I think there are other people that may be unmoved by this. And as we know from a lot of the Kaiser Family Foundation polling, people have a variety of reasons for not being vaccinated. We know that often, especially in communities of color, there is a distrust towards institutions that have harmed our communities. And I know that a lot of conversations I have, especially with that gentleman who stopped me on the street, that was one of the concerns of his friends. But with conversation, patience, and a lot of discussion, they decided to get vaccinated.
You know, one of the other data points, or one of the things that noted in this report, is that the Delta variant is as transmissible as chickenpox. And so what does that mean for parents of children under 12 years old for whom the vaccine has not even been approved?
Right. And I have, you know, I have a 4 and 6 year old, and I definitely, when I was reviewing this data, you know, I was also very concerned. You know, this Delta variant is more transmissible than most of the respiratory viruses actually in history. And so the concern is going into the school year, you know, ensuring that schools are using multi-layered strategy of masking, physical distancing, testing, ventilation is incredibly important, right? So this virus, just like chickenpox, is airborne. And so ventilation is going to be key. And the concern that I have is in those states where the governors have restricted mask mandates, even in schools. We're already seeing surges in those particular states, and we probably will see, you know, outbreaks related to schools in those same areas as well because of these mask mandates being restricted.
And speaking of mask mandates, I'm wondering, you know, here in Washington, they've been reimposed. In Los Angeles, they've been reimposed. And I'm wondering, for folks who are seeing the news about the Delta variant and might have, you know, family reunions and things like that that are coming up, certainly in the next month, since August is just 2 days away, how concerned should people be about going to big family gatherings as a result of the Delta variant?
Right. And so I know for probably a lot of people, it feels like two steps forward, one step back. You know, right. Essentially, this is a dynamic situation. The situation is evolving. We now have this Delta variant that has thrown a wrench into a really what was a promising situation, especially for the fall. But what I would say for people who are considering family gatherings for August is to obviously avoid indoor areas, and even outdoor crowded areas are also incredibly risky. We're going to have to think about, you know, smaller gatherings, just like we did last fall. We're going to probably have to repeat a lot of those same sort of physical distancing restrictions that we had before, especially if we're in settings where there are other people, we don't know their vaccination status. And so things are changing. It's a dynamic situation. We're going to have to be able to flex to it.
Dr. Uche Blackstock, as always, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Coming up, the Texas Democrats might have won another victory in fighting the Texas voter suppression bill, exposing a provision that could have put more than 100,000 people's ballots at risk. Texas Democrats Nicole Collier and Sinfronia Thompson will join us next. Texas State Democrats have been in Washington for 18 days in a desperate last-ditch effort to block one of the nation's most restrictive voter suppression bills from passing in a special session of the Republican-led state legislature. But to focus on the end of the fight, the bill is to overlook what Texas Democrats have already won, a provision that would make it easier to overturn election results removed, a provision ending Sunday early voting, a.k.a. souls to the polls, out. And this week, Texas Democrats may have won another victory after Nicole Collier sounded the alarm during a hearing yesterday about a provision that could put more than 100,000 Texas voters at risk of having their ballot rejected.
I just want to talk about one of the provisions in the bill. Ms. T, and forgive me, say, for instance, she registered to vote 20 years ago. There's a provision in this bill that would require someone who is eligible to vote by mail to insert their last four digits of the driver's license or social security number, or say they don't have one. Now, Ms. T may have registered 20 years ago. She may not remember which one she provided when she originally registered to vote. Under the provisions of this bill, if she put down the other number, even though it's the correct one, her ballot would be rejected. And there's no cure opportunity within this bill to cure her ballot. And she would not even know that her ballot had been rejected.
And now here's what Texas Republican Congressman Pat Fallon said, following up.
I got a text from your colleagues that are in Austin, and on your concern, Representative Collier, about the TDL and the Social Security number not matching, they are aware of it. They said they discussed it with y'all, and they are going to cure it via an amendment.
Joining us now are Texas State Representative Sinfronia Thompson, who represents the Houston area. She is the dean of the Texas House Democratic Caucus. And Texas State Representative Nicole Collier, who represents the Fort Worth area. She is chair of the Legislative Black Caucus. Thank you both very much for being here. Representative Collier, do we have confirmation that Republicans are going to pull that provision?
Well, you know, that's the first time I heard that. I have not been in contact with them. They have not reached out to me. I was not aware. In fact, at the hearing, the 23-hour, more than 23-hour hearing that Ms. T, the dean of the Texas Democratic delegation, was at, they offered amendments to the bill, and they were all rejected under party lines. So this is just another play that they did in the regular session where they made promises and made commitments, but they were all unfulfilled. So I would hope that they would keep the promise, but I'm not going to hold my breath on it.
So you haven't heard anything at all about what the congressman said to you, just to confirm.
No, in fact, I had to go to Congress. I had to come to Washington, D.C. to hear from a congressional member that the Texas House members are willing to negotiate or make revisions to their anti-voter bill.
Mm-hmm. Representative Thompson, great to see you again. You've been in town, as has Representative Collier, 18 days. You have yet to meet with President Biden. Are you hopeful that you will be able to meet with him in the time that you are here? And if you do, what would you want him to understand about the fight for voting rights, not just in Texas, but what it means for America?
I would like for him to understand that we are Americans who deserve the same voting rights that every citizen has, and that it is time for us to stop fighting the same fights of the past in order to be able to have a voice in our democracy.
You know, you said something to me in our conversation that I had with you on my podcast at the Washington Post, Representative Thompson. You said, We're regressing back to a place in history where we want to limit minorities' right to participate in their democracy, just like my grandmother was limited in her right to participate in democracy. In the end, do you think when this is all done, when you have to go back to Texas, that you will be able to go back to Texas, both of you, and say that you did indeed win something as a result of this fight?
I do believe we can. Because when we came here 18 days ago, it seemed to be an issue on the back burner. But our tenacity on the Hill and our persistence has caused the needle to be moved toward activity. Even today, we learned that the Speaker of the House, the majority leader, and another senator went to meet with the president to talk about the bill, the voting bill. And we know that we need preclearance, and we need preclearance with retroactivity to it 2 to 3 years. And that would solve the problems. We would not have the problems that we have in Mr. Capehart if Texas was not a state that's 83.5% people of color.
Representative Collier, I think this is going to be last question to you, and that is this. In your meetings in Washington here, how prominent is the discussion, or how prominent is talk of the filibuster, doing away with it, reforming it, carving out a provision so that voting rights doesn't have to survive a filibuster? How big is filibuster in your conversations?
Well, you know, I think we need to get to the substance of the measures. You know, what are they going to do? Are they going to amend the For the People Act and add a provision? You know, what we really need to see is a preclearance provision with a 5-year look back. And whether that preclearance is based on historical data of a state like Texas, who has a history of discrimination against people of color, or are we going to look at those states that are now having a higher rate of people of color and look at the practical implications? So we just want to make sure that they are continuing to have those discussions and moving the needle forward, like Ms. T said, to make sure that they can get towards that discussion of the filibuster. But we got to start with the substance of the bills and make sure that they can have a consensus so they can move forward quickly.
Texas State Representatives Nicole Collier and Sophronia Thompson, thank you both very much for joining us tonight. Coming up next week could be make or break week for President Biden and Chuck Schumer's very ambitious 2-track plan on infrastructure. That's next. Today, the Senate jumped over the next procedural hurdle to move forward with consideration of the bipartisan infrastructure package. Senators voted 66-28 on a motion to proceed, a vote that will open up the package to potential changes through the amendment process. It remains to be seen whether there will be any amendments because the final text of the bill hasn't been released. Majority Leader Schumer believes amendment votes could happen this weekend, keeping the chamber on track to pass the deal before the August recess.
The Senate remains on track to reach our goal of passing both a bipartisan infrastructure bill and a budget resolution with reconciliation instructions before the start of the August recess. It's an ambitious deadline, absolutely. But the hard work put in by senators and staff means that we are on the right track to get it done. Given the bipartisan nature of the bill, the Senate should be able to process this legislation rather quickly. We may need the weekend. We may vote on several amendments. But with the cooperation of our Republican colleagues, I believe we can finish the bipartisan infrastructure bill in a matter of days.
Joining us now is Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for NBC News. Okay, Sahil, when will we actually see the text of this bipartisan package?
Hey, Jonathan, it's a good question. And as of 2 hours ago, I was told by an aide involved in writing this that it could be done as early as tonight. Now, the night is running out of moments left if I look at the clock. So I suspect it's not going to be done tonight. But the hope is that it's done tomorrow and at some point this weekend they can begin this process, hopefully for, you know, to stay on Chuck Schumer's schedule for Democrats. Wrap it up by early next week and get the budget resolution done, that $3.5 trillion vehicle, before they head home for the August recess.
Okay, so you and I both know Capitol Hill, and we certainly know how Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell operates. You and Benji Sarlin have written a piece, What's in it for McConnell, because he hasn't blown this up. So what's in it for McConnell?
It's a question that a lot of people on Capitol Hill are asking, Jonathan. Of course, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell is best known for denying bipartisan victories to a Democratic president. He has self-styled himself the Grim Reaper of progressive legislation, and he appears to be going along with the top priority of President Biden. So why is that? And there are a couple of reasons, according to many conversations I've had with his top allies and even some of his critics. The first is that many Republicans in his Senate caucus want this bill. They are invested in it. That includes retiring members like Rob Portman, you know, who is in legacy mode, thinking about how he will be remembered. It includes people like Lisa Murkowski, who came to Washington to do things and not just obstruct things. McConnell is not omnipotent. He's got to give them what they want sometimes. Otherwise, his own position could be jeopardized. The second reason is that McConnell is eager to preserve the filibuster. And there are two moderate Democrats, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who are strong supporters of the filibuster. They happen to be authors of this bipartisan bill. Allowing this to pass would give them the talking point they need to go to progressives and say, see, the Senate actually works. We don't have to nuke the 60-vote threshold. That and the fact that infrastructure is popular, there's little opposition to it, and former President Trump's missives trying to blow up this deal have, according to one Republican senator I spoke to, have had almost zero impact on the caucus. So there's just little downside for McConnell to allow this to happen.
In the less than a minute that we have left, Sahil, can you tell me, explain why Senator Kyrsten Sinema is threatening to scuttle the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill? What's up with that?
Sinema has said she opposes the $3.5 trillion price tag. Now, she did not say why. She did not identify policies specifically that she opposes, because there aren't policies in this bill. It's currently just kind of a concept. So that's her position. $3.5 trillion is too much. In theory, $3.4 trillion could be viable for her. So she's not necessarily trying to blow it up altogether. That said, the fact is progressives viewed $3.5 trillion as a compromise itself. They wanted $6 to $10 trillion. And some progressives I spoke to, including Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Progressive Caucus in the House, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, are not happy with the fact that she is objecting to $3.5 trillion. AOC accused Sinema of trying to nuke this entire process, including the infrastructure deal, including that reconciliation bill, which, by the way, are tied together in the House. These have to come up around the same time in order for Speaker Pelosi to consider either, because the House progressives have threatened to blow up the bipartisan deal unless they get President Biden's other priorities, Jonathan.
And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has made it clear she wants them both together. NBC's Sahil Kapoor, thank you very much. That is tonight's Last Word. I'm Jonathan Capehart. You can catch me tomorrow on a special edition of The Sunday Show here on MSNBC. I'll be joined by former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke and the Reverend William Barber to discuss their 4-day voting rights march from Georgetown, Texas to Austin. So watch The Saturday Show tomorrow at 10 a.m. Eastern on MSNBC.